We welcome you to the second EvoCell podcast. I'm Siri, one of the EvoCell PhD students researching into how to communicate single-cell research through a virtual exhibition.
And I'm Milena, and my research is about how things in the plankton swim.
This time we were in Villefranche at the Oceanographic Observatory talking to Kat Munro, who is a postdoc here. Kat is a jellyfish expert. She did her PhD in the US working with sylphanophores, which are a group of jellyfish, and she mostly worked with a bioinformatics approach. After her PhD, she moved to France to focus more on lab work and microscopy and a different type of jellyfish called Clitia hemispherica.
And we are currently doing a very, very long bioinformatics course where Kat was one of our instructors, so she was also nice enough to sit with us and talk about jellyfish and programming and just general academic life. Hi, Kat. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Can you start with just a little intro?
Sure. Okay. So, Katrina Munro is my full name. I did my PhD at Brown, and I've been in Villefranche since October. So it's about 8 months now that I've been here for my postdoc. Where actually I've moved away from the computer and I'm completely in doing wet lab work. Focused on trying to develop Clitia as a model for live imaging, particularly the early steps of meiosis. But during my PhD, I did a lot of bulk RNA-seq analyses, which was sort of how I ended up getting roped in as an instructor for this course.
How do you find it, like the change from working at the computer and now working in the wet lab?
I really like it. I like being on the computer, so it's been really nice. Actually, these last few weeks to be getting back to that. I think my ideal routine would involve a bit of both. So for my PhD, I had a huge fieldwork component. So I collected the specimens and then sequenced them. And then probably the vast majority of my time during my PhD, when, you know, once everything was collected, I was actually at the computer with some work in the lab as well. And I think my ideal balance would involve being in the lab maybe even a bit more than I had been, but also having components of computer work and analyses as well. So I like both.
Did you learn most of the computer stuff after you started the PhD?
So I learned everything during the course of my PhD, which I think is a similar situation for all of you, which is that maybe some of you came in with some prior experience, but many of you are learning it as you go along through your needs in terms of the data that you're collecting and how you need to analyze them.
Yeah, just from this perspective, it looks like 4 years is not enough to acquire, say, all the vast amount of knowledge that you have.
But it is. I mean, it really is. I hope that it's a very steep learning curve. So it will feel like an insurmountable challenge right now at this point, but I think by, you know, your second or third year doing all of this, you're going to forget how hard it was at the beginning, and you're going to realize that you've actually learned an absolute load about coding and doing analyses. You sort of learn initially by necessity, and it feels really daunting, but over time, I think you'll feel very, very skilled and confident. I promise you.
Sounds fake, but yeah. I'll take it.
No, really, I promise you.
I am always a bit afraid while I'm doing my research. So I'm not doing bioinformatics or lab work. I'm doing more qualitative analysis, and because this is new for me as well, I'm always afraid, do I forget something? Is there something I don't know? Am I doing my research wrong? Is it something I'm not considering, some kind of point of view? And all these thoughts are often stopping me in being productive or like getting further into. I need to feel that I'm an expert
right.
in certain things that I can be very productive and confident in what I'm doing.
Right. So for you, so in the context of coding, I think you actually have quite a bit of R experience and things like that.
Yeah.
But you don't necessarily feel like an expert when you're doing it, or is it a broader concern?
No, the kind of analysis I'm doing is like qualitative analysis in a way.
Right.
So it's more looking into communicating actually the project, so it's not sitting on the computer and doing sciences in that way, but actually looking into how to create an exhibition.
Right.
And for that, I'm interviewing experts in museums. I'm interviewing the fellows and looking into how their attitude is towards science outreach.
Very positive. Yeah. Very, very positive.
And looking at different examples, how molecular biology, for example, has been communicated in mm-hmm. the past. But, like, I don't know what is the standard. I learn more and more, and mm-hmm. I do have people who help me with it. But
right.
it's, I think it, I hope I'll have a similar like learning curve in that way.
Well, yeah. This is the like different PhDs. Some start with a more predefined project. I think mine is pretty well defined. Some mm-hmm. are more exploratory mm-hmm. in the initial phases. I don't know, what was yours like? Like, how specified was your PhD project when you were just starting? Did you know exactly what you were supposed to do?
No. So I did my PhD in the US. I think that they can be, you know, depending on where you do it and depending how you're brought in, at least where I was, you were given a lot of freedom and a lot of independence. So my advisor did have a grant that focused on RNA sequencing, but I had a lot of freedom in some of my other chapters to explore ideas independently. And I really liked that. But there is this element of worrying about not being the expert or worrying about what is the best way to go about doing something. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe that feeling will never go away. Maybe it will become even worse as you become more skilled. I mean, it's part of being a scientist, right? Is always wondering what the best method is. And sometimes the best method hasn't been developed and you may need to be the one to develop it. And that can feel like a really uncomfortable space. I think that maybe during the course of a PhD, you start to feel comfortable with that, more comfortable with not knowing and more comfortable with the fact that you're really pushing the frontiers of knowledge. And so there's you and others and you're trying different methods and different techniques. And that's part of actually being an expert, I think, and becoming an expert is becoming you're comfortable working in this space where things are unexplored and you're on maybe more uncharted territories.
Again, sounds fake. No, I don't see us getting there anytime soon, but hopefully the steep learning curve is true. So during your PhD, what's sort of the biggest uncharted territory that you went into?
So one of the biggest things that I was working on and that I'm still interested in is how you compare gene expression patterns across different species. And in particular, how you do that explicitly using phylogenies and phylogenetics. And so part of that was, frankly, using existing tools. Like in this course, we talked about phylogenetic independent contrast. So using some of these tools and trying to apply them to expression data. And this is something that some people have started to do and have been working on. But some of this space felt very, very unexplored. And I also worked with a group of species called siphonophores, so they're cnidarians, and many aspects of their development and their colonial organization is relatively undescribed. So I'm also working with species where aspects of their biology is completely unknown and unexplored. So you have this intersection of two things of like applying methods where the space has been relatively unexplored on species where aspects of their biology is relatively unexplored.
Were you working with different life stages of the siphonophores?
They have asexual reproduction. Once the colony is fully formed, they produce these, they asexually bud different bodies, or they're called zoids, that are arranged kind of linearly along a stem. And so most of what I worked with was with these development in the context of looking at asexual development. But actually, I came out to Villefranche originally during my PhD to try and work with the early larval development, because they also have a sexual part of their life cycle. And I really wanted to do that, but I wasn't able to to actually collect too many larvae to actually pull that aspect of the project off, which was also another thing that I learned in my PhD, was how to deal with or cope with the fact that not all of your... You can have really great ideas and they may not come together for reasons outside of your control.
But then maybe you can come back to it at some point in your life.
I would love to. Yeah, I have a bunch of those projects on kind of on the back burner where it's like, I really want the answer. And some of, and when it's, especially when it's out of your control, you know, you hope that someday you're going to be in a position where you're ideally placed to answer those questions.
Yeah, at the moment I have like so many questions in my mind I would like to explore throughout this PhD, and I realize, okay, maybe there's also, it doesn't make much sense to go into all directions because in the end I won't have like a sort of a storyline in my thesis, and it won't make much sense. And but like, did you have like in the end when you wrote up like your thesis, did you have a storyline or did you have like different chapters going into different directions and then somehow summing everything up?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I think I there were points where I felt like they were, I had some very independent chapters. They were all maybe arranged around the theme of siphonophores. But when I actually sat down and thought about it, I mean, my chapters were organized into these very logical units that sort of fed into each other. And I think that can happen when you're working on a PhD. You find one thing and you think, ooh, but what about this aspect of it? I was able to have maybe more of a storyline. But I think it is important to have this cohesive unit that forms your PhD. But.
And that is fully executable in our markdown, yeah. Which I'm still very impressed by.
I was maybe a little ambitious to write everything in our markdown, but I'm really happy I did. I learned a lot, and actually saved me a lot of work down the line because I wasn't asked to reformat anything after I handed it in, which was really great.
Sorry, I have no idea what a markdown is. I'm just listening to it and I was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, because I think you were gone at the end of last week. So yeah. We talked about Knitter and Bookdown, which are these two packages in R that you can use to render text and code within a single document, so within an HTML or PDF.
Oh, is it like LaTeX?
It actually uses LaTeX. So you'll pass, I think it passes things through LaTeX in order to generate a PDF, but you write it in this markdown syntax. And R has a markdown syntax that is compatible with this program. And so I had written my whole thesis using Bookdown, which meant that all of the code that was used to generate the plots and everything is all within the thesis, and you can just click one button and it will produce the booklet that is my thesis, which was really satisfying at the end. And then if I found errors or I wanted to change something, I could just rerun the whole thing.
Does it give you automatically a really nice layout?
Yeah, so it gives you a nice layout. And if you want to, so it has its own, so Bookdown has some preset layouts, but if you really want to get under the hood and start changing things, you have to become more familiar with LaTeX, which I ended up having to do, which was actually something I had hoped to avoid, but I ended up digging into it because there would be these little issues that I wanted to fix, and then I found myself on all these LaTeX forums.
I wrote my bachelor thesis in LaTeX, but then in my master's actually again in, I think it was just Word, but I found it easier to kind of read the text.
Yeah.
It's quite difficult, I find, like to write it and then in such a, I don't know, plain environment. Mm. And I like the visual structure while writing somehow.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the way that I got around that issue is it's called knitting or building. You can build your Bookdown book and see it as you go. So you would just have your PDF popping up so you could just stop, take a break, have a look through the PDF and feel good about how your plots are arranged relative to the text and all of that. I recommend it, but
I'm going to try it. Now, like after you showed all the perks of this, Word seems very primitive in comparison. So I'm for sure going to try it. To get back to research and things for a bit, as impressive as our markdown is, can you tell us something about like the coolest findings that you have from your PhD thesis?
I did not read your papers. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
You were our second choice for this podcast. So
oh, wait, who was first choice?
It was Max Salford, who had an experiment and then left. And hopefully we get to talk to him next time. But
I don't know. We'll see. Yeah. We'll see if he matches up to me.
I mean, it's nice to talk to you because you're sort of, we can relate to you more, I think, because you're closer to us in like age and position.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a more normal conversation. I hope. We'll see how it comes across.
Is this part going in?
Probably not. So your thesis and the cool findings of it.
Sure. So not everything from my thesis is published yet. I'm actually, especially my RNA-seq stuff, I'm still actually running some additional analyses. So for my RNA-seq work, it was aimed at looking at these different bodies or zoids in different siphonophore species and comparing the expression across these different species and bodies. And so one exciting thing is that I'm using mapping gene expression data to gene trees and then looking at changes in expression on these gene trees and actually hopefully providing some methodology that others can use to compare expression patterns among different species for a given, you know, tissue or maybe even cell type. And so what I'm doing right now, actually, in sort of my nights and weekends, is using an additional data set, which is a data set that looks at mammalian organs. And it's, again, a bulk RNA-seq data set, and applying these methods to that to kind of validate it, because maybe one of the issues of working at the intersection of not sort of interesting or unfamiliar methods and unfamiliar species is one thing we were worried about is really making this accessible to the broader community, where if you know they don't necessarily care about siphonophores and they're not sure why to use these methods, that they may not actually necessarily read the paper, and then for the siphonophore people, they may not necessarily care too much about the methods. So by applying this to a broader group that is also better characterized in terms of what the genes are actually functionally doing, we're hoping to target that and maybe a broader audience. So that's one, well, probably several papers that I'm hoping to get out as soon as I can. But the other thing I'm actually quite proud about, one of my favorite papers from my PhD was actually looking at the Portuguese man-of-war.
What is that?
So it's a siphonophore, surprise, surprise, that floats at the ocean surface.
Can we just quickly, can you tell us what exactly siphonophores are? So they're jellyfishes in there, right? Or,
yeah, so they belong to this group called Cnidaria, which includes includes corals and anemones and jellyfish, sort of what we would call true jellyfish, or scyphozoans. There's a group called Scyphozoa that include like the moon jellyfish. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It is really popular in aquaria. You'll often see moon jellyfish, box jellyfish, and then also hydrozoans. So Clitia hemisferica, which is one species that I'm working on here, and that Anna from the group is working on, is a hydrozoan.
Mm-hmm.
And within hydrozoa, there's many different groups, and of which siphonophores are one. So they're colonial, and they are found in the open ocean from basically the surface of the ocean to the deep sea, different species occupying different depth ranges.
Is it likely we can see some here in the water in Villefranche?
Yeah, actually, this is a pretty good spot for siphonophores, actually, because the bay is quite deep and there's an upwelling that has historically brought siphonophores, especially in the spring, less so now, but there's a high number of siphonophores that are brought in the spring that are collected in the plankton. And if you're swimming, I've actually been swimming off the dock here and been able to see siphonophores in the water.
How big are they?
Depending on the species, they range from a couple of centimeters to some of the deep sea species can be meters long.
And are they can you feel them? Are they stingy.
Yeah, so some species sting humans. Well, I guess they all sting, but not all cnidocytes will penetrate or have toxins that would affect
us. When I'm here in the water, I swim and I keep feeling something which is like stinging. That's what I think is.
I think that might be. Yeah, those are small. Those aren't siphonophores. I think that's some other.
I think it's like 90% paranoia. Actual
it's also me of like being like a bit uncomfortable into very deep water. Like Milena's like keep pushing me to go very far.
So there are some scyphozoan jellyfish called pelagia that are really common here, and they have quite a nasty sting. And you would see them, I hope. They're quite big and they're pink. And it's really if you kind of get the tentacles on the underside, those are what will give you a painful sting. And so a lot
genuinely
of
hope we won't see them.
Yeah, well, hopefully you. Yeah. If you see them, you just sort of avoid them. But I have been stung by some siphonophore species, and so the Portuguese man of war is just to bring the conversation back around.
Well done.
The Portuguese man of war is infamous for its sting. So it floats on the ocean surface, and it doesn't actively move, so it actually has this gas-filled float that it uses as a sail to travel by the wind. And so if there's a prevailing wind that's coming onto the shore, you can have in certain places really large numbers of Portuguese man-of-war that will wash up onto the beaches. And so a lot of, for people that are from areas where there are lots of Portuguese man-of-war, they're very familiar with them, and especially surfers. I've met lots of surfers who will encounter them, and they have a really nasty sting that's quite painful, and it can also, the tentacles can wrap around your arm. And so it can be, for the most part, unless you were stung by a lot of them or you were particularly allergic, not deadly, but it would be a pretty painful time. So that's why a lot of people know them
with them during your PhD?
Yeah, so I had a part of my RNA-seq work involved collecting different of these different body types from the Portuguese man-of-war, but I became really interested in their colonial organization. Because they have this, because they're part of this group of organisms called the Pleustin. So the Pleustin are organisms that float at the ocean surface. Yep. And there's this whole community, actually, of organisms that exist in this world, sort of either at the ocean surface or just directly below, that are, I think, totally fascinating. And there's just this one siphonophore species that does this, but there are obviously other species that are part of the Pleustin. They have these really unique adaptations to this habitat. And so I was really interested in understanding their colonial organization. And since I needed to sample the zoids, I needed to understand which zoids I was sampling and where I would find them. And so I have this paper that's sort of a redescription of the organization and also the early larval development of this species, which I had a lot of fun collecting them and for this paper, and I had a lot of fun really just doing a basic morphology descriptive paper. And it, perhaps because it represented this really independent component of my PhD, where I went out and I got my own money and I went to collect the Portuguese man of war on my own and had a really great field season working with really fun collaborators, but I have a real soft spot for this paper because it was just so much fun to work on and to write, and the species is just really fascinating. And I hope it's triggered a bunch of other projects within the lab now, and I really hope that it's going to start going to take off and there's going to be lots of people interested in looking at aspects of the Portuguese man of war biology.
And what is like the most interesting about these?
there's lots of things that are really interesting about them. So one cool area to follow up on is how they deal with really high UV. So there's actually, because they're floating at the ocean surface, they're exposed to the sun all the time. And there's lots of animals that have to cope with this. And there's one postdoc in my former lab who's now following up on that question and trying to look at this from a molecular level and trying to identify, in particular, if there are compounds, which there is some some papers from the 60s that suggest that there are, that are involved in absorbing UV and kind of acting as like a natural sunscreen. So I think that's one cool thing that they do. There's other...
So this is something that's not pigments? Or
It's unrelated to... So they also have blue pigments that mm-hmm. seem to be... It's suggested that that might be involved more in kind of camouflaging because they may be susceptible to like aerial attack by birds that want to eat them. So they have these blue pigments, but it seems to be distinct from them. So that's one thing that's really interesting about them. There's other cool things to follow up on. Like they produce carbon monoxide in the float. Actually, all siphonophores do. But the Portuguese man-of-war float is really large. It's much larger than any other siphonophore. So it gives you, for experimental work, having something that's so big and having such a big gas gland that's producing carbon monoxide, you can start to look at how animals would produce carbon monoxide. And there's some reason to expect that it might be kind of energetically kind of intense. So
wait, what did they use the carbon monoxide for?
To inflate the float. So they have use carbon monoxide to fill it. Actually, in the Portuguese man of war, it seems like there's a lot of gas exchange at the surface. So there's a lot of air, but the initial gas that they produce, it seems to be carbon monoxide. But in the deeper species, you don't see that gas exchange. So it is a much higher percentage of carbon monoxide that they're producing from these aeriform cells in this gas gland. So these are unexplored questions that I hope people, I know that there's people interested in exploring, which is really exciting. But to do all of that, we also need to have a handle on basic aspects of their morphology and development and have a really nice description. So this paper, I hope, provides a nice foundation for people to start doing that.
Wow, it's super cool. And so they producing carbon monoxide, mm-hmm. right? And how much is that, like, compared to, I don't know, other animals that may produce? So, like,
I mean, obviously not enough to, like, contaminate the atmosphere since we're all still alive.
Yeah, no, but it's a good question. Like, how do they handle... So there are cells that produce carbon monoxide, as far as I understand, in other species, but how do you handle really, really high levels, and how do you protect your tissues from being affected by carbon monoxide? And I'm not really sure how they're doing that. Yeah.
I want to get into something like more existential that I keep asking everyone in science. So you worked with jellyfish, and something that is not like, how do we protect surfers from not getting stung by them? And so, like, to me and to everyone in the network, it is obvious that those are questions that you need to work on because they are cool and they're interesting. And, you know, we want to know how nature works, etc. Mm-hmm. But then there's, like... You know, why should people give us money? How do you justify your research to someone who is more utilitarian in what science is supposed to be about?
Obviously, I think we should support basic research for itself, but I agree not everyone is necessarily going to be on board with that. And I think for people who are super, super utilitarian, I think what I end up landing on is giving concrete examples where basic science has led to some sort of medical application that is directly useful to humans.
GFP.
GFP, right? Yeah, so I work on cnidarians, and GFP is one case. It may feel a little abstract to some people still, why we would need GFP in order to visualize cells. CRISPR would be another one. Mm-hmm. So looking at, you know, weird bacteria and these weird repeats, and then suddenly we're discovering we have this fantastic editing tool. So I guess that's probably the most utilitarian argument.
Also to understand, like, what we're doing now in the network is, like, trying to understand the evolution of cells, mm-hmm. and that may help to understanding how cancer comes, mm-hmm. like...
No, don't mention cancer. I don't want it to be related to cancer. We are not doing anything related... No, actually, there is a person in the network working on cancer. Never mind. But yeah, we are not curing cancer.
No, and I think that's okay. I think sometimes I think people can go too far, and it can lead to this impression that this the science that we're doing here will have a direct application for curing cancer. And the reality is that scientists work in the spectrum of working in basic research or somewhere in between basic research and applied. But a lot of people who are working on applied research are relying on things that were developed in basic research. And that's sort of what I would say to people, is that if we don't have this base of people who are investigating all of these things, then there's going to be a smaller pool to draw from. And especially for us, we're working on really diverse organisms. And a lot of what we know about biology is really focused on a really small number of organisms. And we need to expand that. We can learn a lot more by looking at different species.
I guess by having also time and the creativity, there's chances to maybe find something completely new and exciting, and then
a cancer cure.
Yes.
Yeah, but I do think it's dangerous, because I do think it is valuable for itself. And I think about, you know, what I do. I work with a lot of marine organisms that are, I think, incredibly charismatic. And I think a lot of other people do too. So like Blue Planet 2 was huge in the UK and in the US when it came out there. And I don't know if any of you watched it. And for example, the segment on Portuguese manowar, I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous. So people clearly appreciate watching these things. And I think it's really important to point out that everything that they're being told, all of these facts, is grounded in real science and real studies that people have conducted in order to understand why does this organism do this. And I think when you frame it that way and hopefully instill this sense of wonder, they might also appreciate the basic research. Because I feel like, and maybe I'm already inclined this way, but you know, I think physics is fascinating. I think astrophysics is fascinating. I don't think anyone questions why, maybe some people do, why we should be going into space and why we should be looking at, you know, life on other planets. And I don't know.
Questioning that really? As well. Yeah, you know, like, why are we looking at other planets when there's so many problems to solve on our own planets?
Mm-hmm.
So we should just postpone it until everything is working perfectly.
I think those kind of research, the research we are doing, is helping and gaining different perspectives in a way that maybe we can appreciate biodiversity more. Oh, by watching Blue Planet, people may think, oh, I actually want to use less plastic, or like just appreciating what we have, or understanding life a bit more. And I think being a scientist is also being a bit more like asking a lot of questions, and it's like this childish behavior, but like feeling, just asking the questions, and who maybe some, when you grow older, feel like you can't or don't have time to do this anymore, and which is a shame.
So I am fascinated by animal diversity. That's something that kind of gets me up in the morning. And particularly, I'm pretty crazy about cnidarians now, I think, especially after my PhD. Before going into my PhD, wasn't super specialized in only working in cnidarians, but I think that they're a group that has a lot of really interesting traits that are really unexplored. And, you know, for example, looking at the evolution of life cycles or evolution of functional specialization is something that we can really look at in particular cnidarian groups. So there's a lot of really fun questions, and I feel attempting to answer aspects of those questions is kind of what gets me into the lab. Yeah, it's really hard, and I think it's okay that maybe I don't necessarily understand or wouldn't necessarily find myself satisfied, for example, working on, it sounds terrible, but curing cancer, or, you know, working with an organism where, Drosophila, for example, like fruit flies, they're amazing organisms. They have tons of tools available to them, and lots of people love working in systems or on organisms that are very, very well understood, and they would find it completely incomprehensible why I would work on an organism where there's many aspects of their biology that are unknown, and there aren't so many tools that we can use in order to explore this. And so maybe we will end up agreeing to disagree on working on different systems. But for me, I think it's really fun that the field is completely open, and that at least in the community that I'm working in, everybody is incredibly nice. So I feel like if there's areas of overlap, it's really, there's room for collaboration, and that I can talk to, you know, my colleagues and say, you know, I'm working on this aspect of things, and we're excited of what everyone else is working on. And I think in other fields it can be highly competitive and maybe a little bit stressful, that you know, if you're working on this aspect of this particular pathway, you may be incredibly stressed because you're about to get scooped by your colleagues. And that could be, for me, I don't find that a particularly attractive work environment to be in. But it also makes it intellectually a really nice space to be working in as well, to know that there's so many questions that can be answered, more than I can answer. And I know that if someone else comes into the field, we can welcome them with open arms, that, yes, would you like to work on this thing? Fantastic. I would love to know the answer.
So I completely agree with it, that it's, I would love to, and what I'm also doing at the moment, working in a field which is completely open and you can be very creative and go into like something new. But what I've seen also is like, okay, you can work in a field where it's very highly competitive, and general science is very competitive. Mm-hmm. And I find, for example, what I've seen so far, and this is also in a field which is not that competitive in the terms of there's a lot of things you can discover, that it leaves you a little room for private life, I mm-hmm. found. That's what I've seen so far. So scientists are quite driven, like science is life, mm-hmm. sort of. And what do you think about this? Like, do you feel sometimes stressed? Like, it's when you, for example, when you finish at 4 and you think, oh, I'm just going to go now to the beach and I'm going to do a bit of, I don't know, kite surfing or whatever. And would you feel like, oh, I've worked way too little? Or do you think it's completely fine as a scientist just to take, like, time off? Like, I sometimes have a bit, like, a bad stomach feeling when I when I feel like I haven't worked enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, everyone's different, right? I see this on Twitter actually all the time. These arguments will flare up where someone's like, the only way to be a scientist is to work all the time. And then people will be like, no, I have this very healthy work-life balance, and that's the only way to be a scientist. And at least for me, I find that I have periods where I work a lot and very intensively, and then periods where I have more of a work-life balance, and it sort of ebbs and flows, and part of it may be determined by external deadlines and things like that, that where I'm working to a deadline, and I find that I am working through the weekend and late into the night. But one thing that I realized in the course of my PhD is, for the most part, where I could, I tried to treat it like a job, you know, that I was coming in the morning and I would leave at a set time, and I would try and take some space in the evening to just clear my head. And I would try to take the weekend, and if that wasn't possible, at least one day. And that worked, I think, really nicely. And I also tried to make space for, you know, exercise. And it also helped that I have a husband who doesn't, he's an engineer, so he works with scientists and he works in academia, but he's not himself a scientist, to kind of remind me to stop. And also to give me perspective, because I think there can be, you know, there'll be days where I think, oh no, I'm never going to get a job in science. And, you know, then what would I possibly do with myself? And you know, he can kind of remind me that, yeah, there's other really cool things that you could do, and that's totally okay. And I think, at least for me, it's helped having a really good support network to remind me to have a bit of perspective and to go outside. And then I also have a dog, and so he reminds me that I definitely need to go outside, because he really needs a walk. And especially when I was writing up, having that space to just go outside and walk was actually incredibly productive. I would say I was, in theory, well, in reality, actually still working. I would be writing in my head, but it was a really productive space, and I felt really good and refreshed after it. So I think there are ways that you can kind of manage being a bit of a workaholic, because I think there is maybe a tendency for a lot of people to push themselves a lot and to work really hard. But we all find, I hope, we try to find our whatever works best for us. And for me, that meant taking time to myself and spending time with, you know, people I cared about.
Mm-hmm. So from what I hear about your PhD supervisor, he is pretty cool, but like in the whole environment of the university, did you ever feel any sort of external pressure to work this and that amount and to prove that you really care by staying at work for 12 hours or more?
I never had that. No, so obviously it depends, right? There are many different advising styles and there are many different lab types and there are many different, you know, departments with very different cultures. So at least for me, the department culture at Brown was really great. We were given a lot of freedom and there was also a lot of respect for us, I think, as researchers and as academics in our own right, that if we have work to do, we will get it done. And we'll get it done within our own space. And my advisor, Casey, was, I mean, yeah, he's not someone to tell you to be in. And maybe it was because he didn't need to, because I would come in, but there was, I never had any feeling like I had to be working these hours or, you know, in the maybe the worst toxic cases you hear of people, you know, leaving, I don't know, a jacket on a chair to make it seem like they're there so that they're working every hour of the day. And at least for me, my own personal perspective on that is that nobody is switched on that for that long. I mean, it's just a lie. You're lying to yourself and you're lying to everyone else. So what's the point? I mean, you need to take breaks. You need to have this, have some sort of space, mixed space in your brain for science, or you're not actually going to be doing a good job of it, frankly. I mean, maybe other people find it works differently for them, but at least for me, I'd be kidding myself if I was pretending that I'm working all the time, because I wouldn't be. I'd be on Facebook or whatever, like reading the news. And I find actually, when I do find myself at that point of, you know, reading the news or whatever, maybe that's time to go for a walk or change it up or do something else or go into the lab, because clearly it's not being productive anymore and there's no point. But luckily I never felt like anybody was watching me anyway, and so I never really had to worry about it.
Yeah, I can only work well if I feel well, and I think my master's degree was quite intense. It was my master's were like for 12 months without proper holidays or anything. And after that, I was so exhausted emotionally as well. I didn't have any puffer anymore. And then I had like, I think 2 months in between, or 3 months in between, and then started now this PhD. Mm-hmm. And I just realized, okay, I need the weekends off. I need, when I don't feel like working anymore, I just go home because there's no point anymore. And
yeah, it sounds horrible to say when I don't feel like working, I go home. But
yeah, or like working, or when I just,
when you don't feel productive anymore, which is a thing, and 8 productive hours a day is better than 12 hours out of which 4 are staring into the void or Facebook or whatever.
Yeah No, I completely agree. I think it's really important, take a break.
Yeah.
Another thing that I want to touch on is so lately on Twitter, I have been seeing a lot of discussion about the ways that women are, I don't think it's exactly discrimination in science anymore, but treated differently based on gender. I never relate to any of this. I have never, ever felt discriminated based on gender. And I ask, you know, women in science in my surroundings, and neither have them. And I wonder, you were in the U.S. That is, I hear, a horrible place full of discrimination.
Oh, no. But,
yeah. And I don't know, any negative experiences that you want to share?
So I guess I'll push back on it being a U.S. problem, because I think people have reported and experienced discrimination in different institutions all over the world in many different cultures. And I don't know that, I think in the US there's a lot of people talking about it, maybe more so than in other places. Maybe that's not fair, but certainly there's a big conversation in the US about
it.
So
I think that's true.
I think there may be kind of a reporting bias that makes it seem like the US is this awful environment to work in. But I would suggest that maybe it may be no better or worse than anywhere else. It's just people are starting to talk about it. I think, Yeah, I think let me tread carefully on this. When I came into science, so my parents are super feminist, and so they raised, and I had two older brothers, and I always did everything my brothers did, and I always felt like the world was my oyster, and I could do whatever I wanted, and if I wanted to become a biologist, which is something I had always wanted to do, then I would do it. And I had my parents' support fully behind me, and I never felt like I was pushed into any kind of gender norms per se, other than that of broader society. But I think as you go on, or at least for me, as I went on, as I'm going through my career, I'm starting to realize that, and I'll let you know how it goes, but that you see this ceiling maybe approaching. So for example, I would say, you know, look at your departments, look at your programs, how many women are there? And then look above that, how many women are there? And then above that, so how many female faculty? Or in addition to that, you know, how many people of color are there, for example, especially, and it's a huge problem in the US, is that these, especially ecology and evolutionary biology departments, are incredibly white, and they can be incredibly male as well.
I mean, you can see, like, our network is like PhD students, we're 8 females and women and 4 males, and the PIs though are mostly male. So
yeah, so where are we all going? And that's one thing that I worry about, right? Is, and in some cases it's you see a lot of people leaving science for various reasons, you know, maybe they have other ambitions. I think having children is one major point where I think people start making decisions and it may end up pushing them out of academia, and that seems to be something that is pretty well reported, but it's something that I worry about, and it's something that people are studying intensively. So I think maybe as I'm coming closer to that, as I'm moving through the ranks, I'm starting to think about it more, about, you know, how the composition of who my colleagues are is changing. And I noticed that it is.
Already in your postdoc?
It's hard to say, right? So here there's 2 of us, and actually we're both women. But I do think about it. And I think I've also, you know, noticed it in some interactions with some people where I do feel like suddenly, hang on a minute, I just said that, but now it's being repeated and it's being accepted. And part of that might be some hierarchical thing, which is then confounded with the fact that hierarchically, it's typically more likely to be a man that is hierarchically above me, as you would say, sort of, you know, as faculty.
That is indisputable. I'm just hoping that we're already at a place where it is changing. So, like, the PIs now are mostly male, but the ones getting hired now and in the coming years hopefully won't be.
I think there's definitely like an increased awareness for it, and I think we're in the right time to make a change. And I think also one of the changes needs to be that, for example, family planning need to be more supported, and also not only in terms of like for women, but also for male. Like, it's also okay for a man who does science to stay, for example, a year at home and look after the kids and be supported by the by the institution. It's I think that's an issue from my point of view. And also, like, for example, how we get supported by the funding agencies as PhD students, it
or
doesn't
beyond.
Make it easier. And
yeah,
I think now we're the most flexible the younger you are in terms of like family planning, but it doesn't make you, it's super difficult to kind of do, I think, both things. It's possible, of course.
Right.
But
yeah,
these are things that are, I guess, easier in the beginning of your career. And this is what I keep hearing, that you may not be encountering any sort of discrimination now, but just you wait. So I'm guessing that as you climb up the hierarchy, it's it's taken more like against you if you had a child. You know, you can be a PhD student and have a kid, because then you don't really do a very responsible job anyway, but how will you be a very well-established professor who's supposed to jugglers all sorts of responsibilities and also have a family. So maybe, I don't know, I still like, I live in this bubble where I hope I will never encounter this.
I mean, I'm really glad that you feel you haven't. And frankly, I think it's not even necessarily that there's a difference between, you know, direct sexism that you may get from your colleagues and can occur. And then there's the kind of structural sexism, which is that, you know, you may work with incredibly progressive colleagues, but you may find yourself in a situation where you had kids and just as a fact of biology, you had to take a bunch of time out and now you don't have, you know, maybe as many papers as the same person who's applying for the same job. Or, you know, you may not have, so in the US, there's a tenure system and you may not, and many, hopefully, many places take that into account. The difficulty is where it's said to be taken into account and where it actually is taken into account and how that works and how that's actually implemented is a big question. And I think even a lot of people, for example, say it's having a child when you're in your PhD is a really good time. But I think it's talking to people is that, in many cases it's not supported. And many people have told me there's no easy time to have a kid and also maintain a career. Even, you know, in your PhD, in some cases you have programs that are really flexible, but not everywhere. And so I think it's maybe easy to say, but I think in reality it is a really difficult time for people as well. You know, I didn't have a kid during my PhD. I don't have kids currently, but, you know, it's something that I think about for, you know, my fellow female colleagues and I worry about. And how, you know, how they can continue to be incredible people and incredibly productive in their fields and that there is, you know, institutional support for that. I do worry about that a lot.
I mean, so in our PhD program, I think there is a parental leave clause written in somewhere there, and it is.
It depends on in which institution it is. So they it goes after. Which country you are at, in living in, and which institution you're at, and if they would just support you in that.
Speaking of countries and living in them, which is a smooth transition, do you want to stay in Europe? How do you like Europe?
I love it. It's great here. In talking about work-life balance, I think certainly, so here in France, I think... And certainly in Villefranche, there's a really good work-life balance here. And actually, one thing I really like about working here is that I find that my colleagues really respect my work-life balance. There's people take vacation, and that's totally okay. You know, no one's judging your what you do in your own time. And it's so I feel like I have a lot of freedom here, which I really like. In terms of staying in Europe. I have an American husband, and he wants to move back to the US. Maybe he'll fall in love with being in France, and maybe we'll stay here forever. We'll see. But at least for now, he would like to move back to the East Coast. So that's sort of the agreement we have, is that we'll be in France for several years during the course of my postdoc, and then it's his turn to decide where we get to live for the next part. Unfortunately, I like working in the US. I really like the Northeast, which is where he's from. And there's a lot of universities there, so that although I'll be geographically restricted in where I search, I hope that there'll be something that pops up that will fit really well for what I want to do. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, I really like it. I really like it here. The system is really different to what I'm used to. So I did my undergraduate degree in the UK and my master's in the UK, and then I moved to the US and now I'm here, so my data points are very few. Mm. But there's a lot of things that I really like about the system here. For example, that you have larger teams with researchers within those teams who aren't necessarily the PI, but they're permanent researchers. Who have a lot of freedom to explore their own research programs.
This is more a French thing than a thing, right?
I think so. Yeah, I don't know. I know, as I said, my data points are limited, but this is certainly something that exists in France, and I really like it. The other thing is skilled permanent technicians in the lab. Sometimes in the US, people are more on temporary contracts, especially technicians or research assistants can be on more temporary contracts, and so this expertise, these people who work long term in the lab, that really doesn't always exist. It does exist in some labs, but certainly not where any of the labs that I was used to or working with. And I think that's really great. They really value skilled expertise here and make positions for it, which is kind of fantastic.
Yeah, shout out to all the skilled technicians. We appreciate you.
Yeah, so much. In the US, I think there's a lot of reliance on PhD students and undergraduates and master's students to do a lot of the work and to keep the lab running.
Yeah, and like when they leave, does like the knowledge get lost, or you have to
sometimes
keep... Yeah.
Yeah, so if there's a gap, or if there isn't good skills transfer, it can leave a big gap. As opposed to having someone who just knows how to do in situ's in this organism, and they can train everybody that comes in, you don't necessarily benefit from having that skilled long-term expertise. So I really like that. There's a lot of things that are really great about the French system. There are lots of things that are great about the US too, I think. So, like, I really enjoyed... I realize you're all doing PhDs currently, so probably won't change, but I did enjoy the freedom and flexibility I had during my PhD in the US. In terms of, obviously, depending on the lab, funding may vary, but in general, there is more money available, and especially small grants that are available to PhD students and also to postdocs to pursue independent projects.
How come? Why do you think there's more money for
capitalism?
Yeah, I think per capita, I may be wrong on all of this, but I think per capita Israel invests the most in research. But I think in terms of money, absolute money, the US actually has kind of a larger pool out there of funds that you can apply for research. But maybe that's complete garbage, so maybe cut all of that out.
I don't know. I just read, I'm from Serbia, and I read in the newspapers the daily budget for researchers there is, say, like 1.1 euro, and this goes for paying the researchers and all their like consumables and things. It is 1.1 euro. Europe is nice. US is also nice. Serbia, do better, please.
It's very little.
Yeah. Shall we close on this depressing note about...
No,
please say something nice and positive about science and...
What are your future plans now in terms of research?
Yes, keeping up with the Cnidarians.
Yeah, so that's my I have, starting last month, I have another 2 years of funding to stay in France to look at Clitia gonads and look at meiosis. So I'm really excited about that. I'm actually really excited about this project because it's a whole bunch of new stuff for me, you know, using CRISPR knockout and hopefully also knock-ins, and getting a lot of experience working with microscopes and microscopy. So these were skills that I didn't develop as much during my PhD, so I'm really excited to be able to develop them over the next few years. And I also think I'm hoping we'll also get some really, really cool results that will be interesting not just to the Cnidarian community, but to the broader community in terms of live imaging of chromosomes and chromosome dynamics during meiosis. This is something that a lot of people are interested in and care about beyond just, the Cnidarians that I work in. And then longer term, I'm not sure. To end on a positive note, I mean, that means that I have hopefully a lot of freedom and opportunities, and I'm really looking forward to what's next and where I will end up next. But it really depends on what jobs pop up, and that will probably determine a little bit more about what I'll be doing and where I'll be. But like this postdoc, for example, was something that was suggested to me, I think, within the last year of my PhD, and I was really excited about it. And if you had asked me at the beginning of it where I would be, I probably wouldn't have said in the south of France. So I'm hoping that something
couldn't have had a better location. I think I've never seen an institute that is better located. It's amazing.
It's pretty great.
Yeah.
So yeah, you should definitely come here. If you get the opportunity and someone says, hey, we have a postdoc opportunity in the south of France, I think you should say yes.
Yeah, definitely. And it's also, I think it's very brave to do such a big thematic switch after your PhD. What you're doing now is so different than what you were doing.
But also, and
you just became an expert in this one thing, and you already decided to start getting expertise in something else.
Clearly, there's something wrong with me.
I think I have science. You can continuously learn. That's exciting.
Yeah, I think it's exciting. I think depending on your personality type. I mean, for me. For whatever reason, I see a fire and like run towards it. So I don't know. For me, I really like challenges and I really like learning new things. But I think depending on different personality types, I think you can have an incredibly productive postdoc staying and working in the same area. If anything, you don't have to worry about, you know, switching your brain around and figuring out basic aspects of the system that you're working
exactly.
in.
Exactly. I like doing things that I'm already good at and like patting myself on the back and saying, good job. This is a...
Yeah, and that's cool too.
Different strokes for different folks.
Yeah, and the nice thing about science is there's room. There really is. There's room for all of us. And thank goodness. So I'm glad that there's different people who want to be doing different things. There's people who want to work on Drosophila and there's people that want to work on Clitia, and that's awesome.
And we have to keep on sharing our knowledge and expertise. So.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time.
I think we did less rambling than last time. Maybe we interview you again in the next couple of years when you're going to be here doing it.
Yeah, in the next couple of years, yeah for sure. Maybe we can wrangle a flight back to talk.
Yeah.
You could catch up.
Yeah, that would be good to do. Yeah, thank you for putting up with us.